caused by, I quote, hate itself of precisely the obsessive and dehumanising kind that Fisk and Bin Laden have been spreading. According to the same message from Professor Judea Pearl of UCLA, I was drooling venom and a professional hate peddler. Another missive, signed Ellen Popper, announced that I was in cahoots with the arch-terrorist Bin Laden. This is 800 words, ladies and gentlemen, in an airline seat over the Atlantic. Mark Guon labelled me a total nutcase. I was psychotic, according to Lillian Barry Weiss. Brandon Heller of San Diego informed me that you are actually supporting evil itself. Quite a lot in 800 words. On an Irish radio show, a Harvard professor announced that I was a liar, a dangerous man, and that anti-Americanism, of which I was apparently guilty, was the same as anti-Semitism. The show's anchor eventually pulled the plug on the professor, but I got the point. Not only was it wicked to suggest that someone might have had reasons to commit the mass slaughter, it was even more appalling to suggest what these reasons might be. To criticise the United States, or to be anti-American, whatever that is, was to be a Jew-hater, a racist, a Nazi. Merely to suggest that Washington's policies in the Middle East, its unconditional support for Israel, its support for Arab dictators, its approval of UN sanctions, might lie behind the venomous attacks of September the 11th, was an act of evil in itself. Oddly, the fact that the mass murderers were all Arabs, and that most of them came from Saudi Arabia, was not, apparently, regarded as a problem by reporters or by government. This fell into the where and what category. And Arab terrorists, of course, are very well known in Hollywood. The sin was to connect the Arabs with the problems of the lands they came from, to ask the why question. I think of this a lot because not just of the extraordinary, amazing preparations for the most powerful nation on earth, yours, to bomb the poorest, but because I was in Afghanistan 22 years ago to watch the Russian invasion of that country. How they fought for us, those Afghans, how they believed in our word, how they trusted President Carter when he promised the West support for Afghanistan once the war with Russia had been won. I even met the CIA spook in Peshawar, brandishing the identity papers of a young Soviet pilot shot down with one of our Stinger missiles, which had been scooped from the wreckage of his MiG jet fighter. Poor guy, the CIA man said, before showing us a movie in his private home cinema about GIs zapping the Viet Cong. It was, I remember, a comedy film. And yes, I remember what the Soviet officers told me after arresting me at the Salang Tunnel north of Kabul, soldiers of the 3rd Soviet Parachute Brigade. They were performing, they said, their international duty in Afghanistan. They were punishing terrorists who wished to overthrow the Afghan government and destroy its people. Sound familiar? I should also tell you that one of the Soviet soldiers insisted that he liked the Beatles. And when I asked him how he understood about the Beatles, how he knew, he said, "We listen to Voice of America." I was working for the Times in 1980, and just south of Kabul, I picked up a very disturbing story. Remember, this is 22 years ago. A group of religious Mujahideen fighters had attacked a school because, so they had heard, the communist regime had forced girls to be educated in the same classroom as boys, and the girls no longer needed to wear veils. So the Mujahideen, who of course were on our side, had bombed the school, murdered the head teacher's wife, and cut her husband's head off. It was all true. I got down to the school, it was still smouldering, and what was left of the two bodies were hanging in a tree. But when my paper, at that time The Times, ran the story, the British Foreign Office quietly complained to my foreign editor at The Times that my report gave support to the Russians. Because in those days, of course, the Afghan fighters were the good guys. Because in those days, Osama bin Laden was one of the good guys. Charles Douglas Hume, then editor of The Times, would always insist that Afghan guerrillas were called freedom fighters in the headline. Your President Reagan once said they reminded him of the Founding Fathers. There was nothing you couldn't do with words. And so it is today. President Bush, of course, threatened the obscurantist, ignorant, super-conservative Taliban with the same punishment as he intended to mete out to bin Laden. Bush originally talked about justice and punishment, about bringing justice to the perpetrators of the New York and Washington atrocities. But he didn't send policemen to the Middle East. He sent B-52s and F-16s and AWACS planes and F-18s and A-10s and Apache helicopters. We were never going to arrest bin Laden. We were going to destroy him. But B-52s, as I wrote before the bombardment began, don't discriminate between men wearing turbans or between men and women or women and children. I say this because I have a particular interest in Osama bin Laden. Back in 1997, I met him, and not for the first time. I had interviewed him in Sudan in 1994, then in Afghanistan in 1996, then again the following year. That last night when we met, I was driven by one of his armed followers hundreds of miles across the mountains of Afghanistan, high up the rugged, towering Kabul Gorge. The clouds were below us, waterfalls of ice clinging to the rock above. One of his gunmen was driving the Toyota and turned to me at one point and said, "Toyota is good for holy war." Bin Laden would not have made a joke like that. After hours of sliding and slipping on the scree above sheer precipices, we reached a plateau of stones and rock where beside us was an air raid shelter 25 feet high and 25 feet wide, cut into the living rock of the mountainside by bin Laden's construction teams at the height of the war between the Afghans and the Russians. A war, of course, in which bin Laden had fought with great courage, being wounded 6 times, fighting, of course, on our side. Indeed, most of his camps, the camps at which the United States aimed its cruise missiles and bunker busters and daisy cutters and all the other infantile names we have for bombs last year, were long known and long on US tracking screens. The Americans knew exactly where all these locations were, and they should know because the Americans built them. The CIA constructed these camps, which we were told were now terror bases. Strange that that simple fact didn't make it into very many of your newspapers. Anyway, that night I waited in a tent along with several of bin Laden's armed followers. I have to say that in the months since September the 11th, I've wondered whether I sat next to Mohammed Atta or any of the suicide pilots to be. I have no idea, and I shall never know. Then bin Laden himself came in, lithe as a cat, but with a slight infirmity, I thought, in one of his feet. I was carrying over my shoulder a school satchel, which I use in rough countries to carry my passport and other documents. But bin Laden saw some Arabic language newspapers in the bag and seized upon them, turning to study them in the corner of the tent in silence for all of 20 minutes. He didn't even know that the Iranian foreign minister had just visited Saudi Arabia, his own country. And I sat there with his men, all of us ignored by bin Laden, and thought how isolated he seemed to be. Didn't he have a radio? Didn't he have a television? When he spoke, it was with a determination, a rather chilling self-conviction, which I had not seen before. I still have my notes of that meeting, and what he said is even more sinister in retrospect. "Mr. Robert," he said, "we fought and beat the Russian army in Afghanistan. We won our battle over the Russians from this very mountain upon which you are now sitting. And that battle destroyed the Soviet Union." From time to time, bin Laden, rather disconcertingly, would clean his teeth with a piece of mishwak wood while you were asking him questions. Then he said, "Mr. Robert, I pray to God that he will permit us to turn the United States into a shadow of itself." Ladies and gentlemen, I couldn't fail to remember those words when I saw those terrible images of New York on September the 11th back in Brussels. The World Trade Center disappeared into two almost biblical columns of smoke, and New York, I realized, was now a shadow of itself. Just one word made me feel deeply disturbed. But bin Laden's power in the Middle East comes, or came, from what he said rather than what he did. I don't think he climbs to the top of a mountain and pulls out a mobile phone and mutters, "Put Plan B into action." Hollywood might have him do that. I'm sure the State Department would. I fear, however, that his awful power and influence comes more from his words. Many times I have listened to them, personally present, his armed followers hanging upon those words as if he was a messiah. He would demand that the American forces leave the Middle East, leave what he called the land of the two holy places, Mecca and Medina, in Saudi Arabia. He demanded the end of what he called the corrupt regimes, which are supported by the West, Saudi Arabia itself, the other Arab Gulf countries, Egypt, Jordan, you know the rest, which torture their own people. He demanded an end to Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. He demanded an end to the sanctions, which are killing tens of thousands of Iraqi children. Whether or not he really felt that strongly, that is what he said. And his words do have a special resonance in an Arab world which has for decades felt humiliated by the West, and especially by America. A world which many of its millions believe has indeed been corrupted and damaged almost beyond repair by the culture and armed might and politics of the West. Without those feelings of despair and humiliation and fury, bin Laden, I think, would truly be a voice in the wilderness, ignored and derided. But to many Arabs, and this is the point, to many Arabs who were appalled for both moral and religious reasons by the staggering massacres in New York and Washington, bin Laden does not sound insane, which is why his voice circulates clandestinely today, even now, on so many thousands of cassettes throughout the Middle East. As Laurie said, I've spent 26 years in the Middle East, much of that time trying to answer the whys. And in no part of the world today is our reporting so flawed, so biased in favour of one country, and so consensual in its use of words. Indeed, the language of Middle East journalism, in my view, has become so cowardly, so slippery, so deferential, so locked into the phrases used by the State Department, the President, and US diplomats, that our reporting has in many cases become incomprehensible. For an American readership unfamiliar with Middle East history or recent events, or for American viewers who may have no intrinsic interest in the region, our reporting, I think, has reached such poverty of expression as to render any real understanding of the conflict impossible. Such is the bizarre nature of our profession in this region that any talk like the one I'm giving to you this afternoon has to follow a kind of mantra. So here goes. Yes, Saddam Hussein is a wicked, cruel tyrant who invaded Iran, when we were supporting him, of course, and then Kuwait. He used poison gas on the Kurds, and let us forget that at that time the Kurds in Halabja were on the Iranian side, and we said nothing about it at that time. His Iranian war cost up to 1 million lives. He truly has a hangman on 24 hours duty. Women are hanged on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And yes, Yasser Arafat is a corrupt, vain little despot, with his 11, some say 13, secret services to beat, torture, and occasionally kill Palestinian opponents. I should add that I never could see why Israel wanted to negotiate with him, unless they saw him as a weak militia ally who could police the West Bank and Gaza on their behalf. Palestinian suicide bombings are a fearful, evil weapon. But we are nevertheless lying about the Middle East because we are distorting the truth, either because we are afraid of criticism from Israel and its supporters, or because we journalists prefer an easy life, unencumbered by hate mail and letters to the editor. Take the pejorative use of that word terrorist. Now, the mass murders of September the 11th may require a redefinition by those journalists, including myself, who normally abjure the word in Middle East reporting on the grounds that it is used exclusively about Arabs. But its overuse, almost as a punctuation mark in any discussion of the Arab-Israeli conflict, terrorism, terrorism, network of terror, structure of terror, 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 remains as poisonous as ever, and perhaps racist. It's difficult to explain to Arabs, for example, why the New York and Washington massacre was an act of terrorism, which it clearly was, but why the massacre of up to 1,700 Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut between the 16th and the 18th of September 1982 has never been called an act of terrorism by journalists or governments. The death toll in Shatila, after all, was more than half that of the Twin Towers. Was this strange omission of the word terrorism because the killers, members of the Christian Lebanese Phalangist militia, happened to be allied to Israel? Did it not qualify as an act of terrorism because most of the murderers were wearing Israeli Defense Force uniforms, albeit with the Tzahal logo blotted out? Or did it fail to meet the terrorism test because Israeli forces had surrounded the camp and because Ariel Sharon, then Israel's defense minister, had sent the Falange into the camps? Not once, ever, has a Western newspaper called the mass murderers of Sabra and Shatila terrorists. Indeed, Israel's own Kahan Commission of Inquiry into the massacre, which I thought was a good document that didn't go far enough, a document which held Ariel Sharon personally responsible for the killings, called the Falangist killers soldiers. This is not an isolated example. When an Israeli reserve officer, Baruch Goldstein, massacred 29 Palestinians in a Hebron mosque on the 25th of February 1994, he was not called a terrorist. CNN referred to him as deranged. Later, the Israeli ambassador in London said that Goldstein was deranged by fanaticism. Other reports spoke of Goldstein as an extremist or a member of a Jewish underground movement, underground with its faint ghostly echoes of the Second World War. Yet when Hamas took its inevitable and wicked revenge with a bus bomb in the Israeli town of Afula, CNN recovered its nerve. Reporter Bill Delaney told us it was an act of Arab terrorism. Of far greater ethical significance was the cover of Newsweek. And here I'd like to have Rick. I need you. Thank you. Just the wrong moment to leave. Can we have that machine? The cover of Newsweek. There it is. Can we put up a little bit so we can see the Palestine at the bottom? Right. This is Newsweek magazine of February 19th last year. Terror goes global, as you can see. I love your American headlines. International Network of Terror, it's all there. Now, beneath these words, as you can see, is a photograph of a Palestinian in a kufiyeh scarf, which almost totally conceals his face, holding in his right hand an automatic rifle. The reader might suppose, and you would suppose, I think, that this is part of the terror network. Indeed, the reader is meant to believe this, and so are you. He's obviously meant to be a member of a terror network. But I was puzzled by this cover picture. You see, I'd seen it before. It was taken by Ilka Yumanen of the Gamma Picture Agency in Paris. Yumanen lives in New York. And when I called him from Beirut, he confirmed the cover picture was his. I took the picture in the West Bank, he told me. It was a member of Tanzim at a Palestinian funeral. Thus, a Palestinian gunman, armed and attending the funeral of a fellow Palestinian killed by Israelis, had been turned into a representative of global terror. Palestinians as a people, and the man on Newsweek's cover is clearly a Palestinian, had been effortlessly transformed into enemies of the world. It wasn't the fault of the photographer, but Newsweek's cover picture there is a lie. The man whose face is covered by the kufiyeh, dangerous though he is to Israelis, has nothing to do with bin Laden or the lead story in the magazine. Thanks, Rick. You can turn the machine off at this point. If Palestinians can be falsely implicated in such a way, and Ariel Sharon, Israel's prime minister, is doing his best at this moment to link Arafat with bin Laden, journalists have gone out of their way to decontextualize Israel's role in the occupied territories. Indeed, once the State Department told its diplomats to stop using the word occupied in relation to the West Bank and Gaza, this was a document from Colin Powell himself. Once the State Department did that, American journalists dutifully followed their example. Henceforth, the land would be called disputed, as in a Time caption, March 10, 1997, Benjamin Netanyahu turns up the heat by okaying new houses, settlements, in disputed territory. Disputed, of course, changes the reality. By deleting occupation from their lexicon, journalists erased the colonies illegally built for Jews, and Jews only, on Arab land. They erased the many Israeli checkpoints, which still covered, as they do today, the West Bank and Gaza. A few weeks ago, I was actually in Beirut, hooked up by the BBC with an Israeli government spokesman who suddenly objected to me calling the West Bank occupied. So I said, well, hang on a minute. You mean when I was driving between Ramallah and Jenin last week, the soldiers who stopped me were Swiss? Or Burmese? You see, disputed suggests an argument about land deeds, or as CNN once memorably put it, conflicting heritage claims. The Associated Press has now gone one further. AP, your largest American news agency. Anxious, of course, to avoid occupied, the agency now refers to lands as being war won. Try that out several times. War won, war won. Kind of difficult to say. They must have had a real reason for having to avoid occupation. I've been searching in vain to find the first use of the phrase settlements and settlers in relation to Israel's occupation. In its Wild West context, I suppose it makes sense. For if the Israelis have taken this land less brutally than America's settlers took lands from their native inhabitants, the word still obscures the reality. These Israeli settlements on occupied, yes, occupied land are colonies, and their inhabitants are colonizers, every bit as much as the French colonized Algeria. When I made this point in my own newspaper, The Independent, a stream of letters accused me of deliberately trying to make a parallel between Palestinian terrorism and the FLN's ultimately successful 1954-62 war for independence against France. I was indeed making that parallel. Interestingly, Sharon himself compared all of Israel to Algeria under French rule, revealing to the correspondent of the French magazine L'Express at Christmas how he told President Chirac of France that, "You've got to understand that we here, we are like you in Algeria. We have no other place to go, and besides, we have no intention of leaving." The French word for a settler, as you know, is colon, accurately representing colonizer, what the Israeli settlers in the West Bank and Gaza are doing. But today, even that tame word settlement is disappearing. CNN, in one of its most recent contributions to journalism, sent out an instruction to correspondents, of which, of course, I have a copy, telling them that Gilo, the Jewish settlement built largely on Arab land south of Jerusalem, is to change its definition. I quote, "We refer to Gilo as a Jewish neighborhood on the outskirts of Jerusalem, built on land occupied by Israel in 1967. We don't refer to it as a settlement." Now, it happens that Gilo is a settlement or colony built for Jews only on occupied Arab land. CNN at least got that bit right, which is partly owned by Palestinians from the village of Beit Jala. Gilo is Hebrew for Jala. It was constructed in violation of UN Security Council resolutions 242 and 338 and against international law. It has also been incorporated into the enlarged municipality of Jerusalem, in itself partly an illegal annexation. But CNN's little lie about neighborhood transforms this history. Cruel and wrong though it is for them to do so, you can see why Palestinians might choose to attack a settlement called Gilo, which they do from Beit Jala. But why on earth would they ever attack a cozy, friendly neighborhood? To fire guns at a neighborhood like San Diego or Long Beach would be the act of madmen, wouldn't it? Or terrorists, mindless terrorists, no less. As the viewer is spared the reality of a settlement, so Palestinian violence against Gilo becomes inexplicable. Asked for a comment by me in Beirut about the style instruction, a CNN spokesman in Atlanta told me down the phone, "We really don't want to talk about this." And I can see why. The BBC has also recently advised its reporters in the Middle East to use the phrase targeted killings for the murder of Palestinians by Israeli death squads, preferring this to assassinations, which, so thinks the BBC, might be reserved for more important folk than the suspected Palestinian gunmen and bombers on Israel's hit list. But it just happens, coincidentally, that targeted killings is Israel's own expression for its killing of selected Palestinians, and I don't believe the BBC was unaware of this. As the growing list of totally innocent civilians killed during these attacks demonstrates, they include women and children, of course, the word targeted is itself highly misleading. When Arab dead are self-evidently innocent, one sure way of spotting Israel's possible responsibility is the use of another of our journalistic cop-outs, the word crossfire. After the Israeli massacre of 106 Lebanese civilians at the UN camp at Qana in Lebanon on April 18, 1996, which followed a Hezbollah mortar attack from the same village on a group of Israeli soldiers laying booby-trap bombs on a nearby hillside, Time magazine ran a photo of a dead Lebanese baby. The caption, "Killed in crossfire." Of course, she had been killed like all the other refugees crowded into the UN compound in Qana by Israeli shellfire. Today, we regularly hear that Palestinians have been killed in clashes rather than shot by Israeli troops. Clashes have become another cop-out word, as if a clash is a natural phenomenon, like an earthquake or a flood. Those responsible simply deleted from the story. I was amused to see, Rick, if we can have the second transparency here, I was amused to see a BBC advertisement obligingly sent to me in the Post for a television documentary about the end of the peace process. Who, I wonder, ever invented the word process that we all parrot? As you can see on the left is the horrifying picture of the Palestinian holding up his bloodstained hands after the savage murder of two Israeli reservist soldiers in the Ramallah police station. On the right here, just before his death, Mohammed al-Dura, the Palestinian boy, shot by Israeli soldiers. There he is with his father, who, of course, was later shot and badly wounded as well. On the back of this card, if we can just take the next transparency there, Rick, is a very revealing text. Of course, it was sent to the foreign editor. You don't need to put the address on the right, you just be the middle. That's it. As you can see, we love logos, we British journalists. Look how correspondence is written. When peace died. Now, what it actually says, as you may be able to read, I'll read it for you, and listen carefully to the text. Two images captured the hatred that has destroyed the peace process in the Middle East. Mohammed, the boy from Gaza, shielded by his father, but still dying under a hail of bullets, and the brutal murder of two Israeli soldiers by a Palestinian mob. Note how Mohammed al-Dura's death carries no attribution. Many Israelis, and almost all the journalists who investigated the case, though not, of course, the Israeli army, and a member of the Israeli Knesset, concluded that Israeli troops killed the boy, although they may not have known, in my view, because I went there too, they may not have known that he was in the direction they were shooting in. So al-Dura's death was caused by a hail of bullets, a distant relation, I suspect, of crossfire, while the killing of the Israeli soldiers is firmly attributed, and rightly, to a Palestinian mob. Thanks very much, Rick. They can turn off that. Almost invariably, investigative reporting is rewarded with hate mail. When I got my hands on a UN-made videotape proving that the Israeli army had a pilotless drone reconnaissance aircraft over Kana at the time of the 1996 massacre, a drone with live-time picture capability, which the Israelis originally said did not exist, the first item of mail to arrive on my desk from London began. I do not like or admire anti-Semites. Hitler was one of the most famous in recent history. You, Mr. Fisk, are a disgrace to a profession that should report the news, which, of course, is what I was doing. I have, over the years, found a rhythm to this kind of correspondence. When Israel scores a military success, the level of hate mail drops. When Israeli troops lose what they believe is the moral high ground, Sabra and Shatila, for example, the level of abuse rises, if the reporter has somehow provoked the news which he reports. The easiest way out of this problem, for many journalists, I fear, is to distort the coverage so that events which are unfavourable to Israel, however dramatic, are buried deep in the story. Just 5 days before the Kana slaughter, an Israeli pilot flying an American Apache helicopter fired an air-to-ground missile at an ambulance packed with women and children in southern Lebanon. The Israeli army claimed, wrongly as I discovered after weeks of investigation, that a Hezbollah fighter, a terrorist of course in Israel's parlance, was in the vehicle. I used the computer-coded markings on the exploded missile parts to trace its origin back to a Boeing factory in Duluth, Georgia. Actually, I took all the bits back to the United States, to Duluth, and put it on the boardroom table where the developer and one of the senior executives, I gave to them copies, photographs of the dead children and women and asked if they felt responsible. And I'll leave you to imagine how the conversation went on from there. The story of the missile, which was initially, the missile was initially sold to the US Marines, taken to Saudi Arabia for use against the Iraqis in 1990, and subsequently given free of charge to the Israelis along with another batch of the same rockets, was later reprinted by Harper's in New York. Yet not a single American news outlet tried to follow it up. The best attempt came from a radio station in Chicago whose reporter eventually rang me in Beirut to say he couldn't write about the missile, quote, because our Defense Department won't confirm the story. I bet they wouldn't. Far sadder was the American coverage of this little atrocity involving the ambulance. Like most other papers in Europe, The Independent front-paged the story. In the latest and most terrible of Israeli attacks on civilians, we wrote, an Israeli helicopter gunship yesterday fired a missile into an ambulance
killing 4 girls and 2 women on board. This at least conformed to the usual style of journalism school, which American would-be reporters attend. We tend not to. The most important part of the story goes in the first paragraph, or so you'd think. But for some strange reason, the New York Times didn't think so. Serge Schmerman, writing for the Times on the 13th of April 1996, began his story like this. Israeli gunboats blockaded Beirut and other Lebanese ports today, and Israeli guns rained shells on southern Lebanon as Israel steadily raised the heat of its operation against Islamic guerrillas. Okay, well, maybe paragraph two. Israeli commanders noted that the guerrillas of the Party of God, the Iranian-backed organization also known as Hezbollah, fired only a few Katyusha rockets into northern Israel today. Where, you may ask, ladies and gentlemen, have the deaths of the 4 children and 2 women gone? Paragraph three, then. They've been able only to fire a very small number of Katyushas, an Israeli officer told reporters in northern Israel today. And so it went on, with details of refugee figures, numbers of guns fired, numbers of shells fired. Only in paragraph six did Schmerman mention the rocket attack. In the deadliest incident today, an Israeli helicopter fired a rocket into an ambulance. There then followed a comment from an Israeli officer who claimed wrongly that the vehicle was being used to carry a guerrilla. Schmerman devoted twice as much space to Israel's justification for this terrible attack as he did describing the victims. Now, I still ask myself why the Times should have shown such a serious distortion in its news values as to relegate what, by its own admission, was the deadliest incident of the day to paragraph six. And I have to ask myself whether, if the situation had been reversed, if a Syrian helicopter had attacked an Israeli ambulance and killed 4 Israeli children and 2 Israeli women, Schmerman and the Times have put this fact into the sixth paragraph. I hope such an incident never, ever occurs. But I have to say that I believe, had the victims been Israeli, Schmerman would have put the attack in the first paragraph. That's where the story should be. That's what they teach you at journalism school. So why did the Lebanese dead only merit paragraph six? Because the dead were Arabs? Or because they were slaughtered by Israelis? It reminds me of the Newsweek edition that was published 2 weeks after the Sabra and Shatila massacre in 82. Its cover story, reflecting the mass demonstrations and very honourable demonstrations in Tel Aviv against the slaughter, was headlined Israel in Torment, with a subhead which read The Anguish of American Jews. I didn't doubt the anguish, but anyone who'd followed the story, and we were on the ground in Beirut, might have more accurately concluded that it was the Palestinians who were in torment, and that it was the survivors of Sabra and Shatila who were chiefly experiencing anguish. Now that Ariel Sharon, the man held personally responsible for the massacre by the Kahan judges, page 93, if you want to check it, is besieging Yasser Arafat in his Ramallah office, it's worth examining just how hard we journalists have tried to avoid his bloody background. When he was Israeli foreign minister in 1998, the New York Times' Serge Schmerman, my old mate again, reported on Sharon's role as mediator at the Maryland peace talks with just a casual reference to the condemnation by some as the defense minister who did nothing to block a massacre in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. Elsewhere in Schmerman's story, Sharon was a veteran of the Arab-Israeli phrase who arouses, wait for it, ambivalent instincts. You bet he does. But who was a tough pragmatist. The word pragmatist, by the way, somehow this word caught on at this particular time. After Sharon became Israeli Prime Minister in 2001, the Sabra and Shatila connection began to disappear altogether from reports. Writing on relations between Sharon and the Bush administration in March of last year, the AP's Laurie Coppens referred only to his hardline views and actions. Excuse me. Reporting from Amman a few days later, the Times' Neil McFarquhar would only go so far as to say that Sharon was viewed in the Arab world as a killer for his long association with deadly attacks on Palestinians. On the same day, Deborah Sontag in the Times talked about Sharon's old instincts as a warrior and his new instincts, here we go again, as a leader who strives to be pragmatic. Now, I know Sharon called his autobiography Warrior, but does the New York Times think Sabra and Shatila fits into the warrior tradition? It's ironic that among the exceptions to the grotesque and misleading journalism coming out of the Middle East, are a few brave Israeli reporters who question the morality of Israel's actions with a ruthlessness that is rare in any European publication and almost totally absent in the United States. Among the most courageous and eloquent of these journalists is Gideon Levy and Amira Haas in Haaretz. Haas, whom I interviewed quite recently, told me that she believes the duty of a journalist is, and I quote, to monitor the centres of power. As good a definition as I've heard for our profession. I should add that I promised her I would always give her the copyright on that quote. But it does raise an important question. How can Amira Haas say things which her American counterparts shy away from? How can Amira Haas report on the cruelty of Jewish settlers and the immorality of Israel's shooting of child stone throwers, as well as the wickedness of Palestinian suicide bombers, when far better paid and supposedly more powerful American journalists cannot, at least not without the weasel words that immunize them from any criticism? Needless to say, Haas not only puts us to shame, but Arab journalists as well. For out in the arid wastes of Arab journalism, there is as little interest in serious investigation of the Middle East's conflict as there is in the United States, as I know to my cost. I was abused as a liar on Damascus Radio in 1982 after describing at first hand Syria's bloody suppression of the Islamist uprising in Hama. I have been called in Egypt a black dog pecking at the corpse of Egypt in the Cairo press for reporting that Egypt's elections were rigged, 98.87% for Mubarak. Do you realise that's 0.02% higher than Saddam gets in his Democratic Party? In all the Middle East, however, nothing quite surpasses our journalistic desire to humour Turkey by obfuscating the reality of the 20th century's first genocide, the deliberate killing of 1.5 million Christian Armenians, most of them slaughtered in 1915, most of them slaughtered in 1915 by the Ottoman Turkish Muslim authorities. No serious academic, except those holding chairs funded by Turkey and the United States, of course, disputes the facts, and anyone who doubts them should read the brilliant, recently published Encyclopedia of Genocide by Israel's foremost Holocaust scholar, Israel Chani. Indeed, The Independent, my paper, now refers to the Armenian Holocaust with a capital H, as in the Jewish Holocaust, which, of course, we also use with an H capital. Much of Chani's horrifying documentation comes from 1915 editions of the New York Times. The New York Times broke the story to the world. Recently, however, these appalling and bloody events have been almost universally referred to by journalists as disputed, like the disputed West Bank, I suppose, or as controversial claims. And most extraordinary of all, the Times, the New York Times, the paper which 87 years ago did more to publicise the massacres than any other paper in the world, has done its bit to discredit the tragedy. Suddenly, it doesn't like its own scoop. Listen to this. In April of 1998, the Times' Stephen Kinzer wrote a report about the 70,000 Armenians who live in present-day Turkey. And here's a key paragraph from the report. Relations between Turks and Armenians were good during much of the Ottoman period, but they were deeply scarred by massacres of Armenians that pro-Ottoman forces in eastern Anatolia carried out in the spring of 1915. Details of what happened then are still hotly debated. But it is clear that vast numbers of Armenians were killed or left to die during forced marches and a burst of what is now called ethnic cleansing. I still read this paragraph, ladies and gentlemen, with a sense of shock. What did Kinzer mean by deeply scarred? Relations between Turks and Armenians came to a virtual end in 1915 because hundreds of thousands of Armenians were no longer alive to have any kind of relations with anyone. And note the intriguing phrase pro-Ottoman forces, which effectively avoids the use of the word Turks or Turkish. Most incredible of all is Kinzer's assertion that the details are hotly debated. Turkey may use its lobby groups to lie about the genocide, and the Turkish government still tries to cover up the massacres as the side effects of civil war. But for the New York Times to present the Armenian Holocaust as a subject of serious dispute is as insulting to Armenians as it is for Jews to hear the facts of their Holocaust disputed or denied. Note, too, how Kinzer talks about vast numbers killed, thus avoiding the all-important figure of 1.5 million, and how ethnic cleansing takes the place of genocide in the text. Another of Kinzer's articles, this time written from the Armenian capital of Yerevan, even carried the headline, "Armenia Never Forgets, Maybe It Should." I find this as outrageous as I would if the New York Times had run a headline stating that Jews should forget the hideous crimes committed against them. During the Pope's recent visit to Yerevan, scarcely a single agency report which referred to the genocide was without a Turkish government disclaimer. BBC World Television's coverage of the papal visit referred to more than 1 million Armenians killed as the Ottoman Empire broke up. Clashes again, I guess. The BBC couldn't bring themselves to tell us who actually killed 1.5 million Armenians. So I asked the same questions I did about our coverage of the 82 Sabra and Shatila massacre. Why do we journalists try so hard to avoid the truth, to extenuate, to dissimulate, to cover up? Is it because Turkey is an important political and military ally of the United States? Because it's a valuable purchaser of American weaponry, which by God it is? Because it's an ally of Israel? Because it has a powerful lobby group in Washington? I know all about lobby groups. Back in 1993, I made a 3-part documentary film for the Discovery Channel here in the States called Beirut to Bosnia, which attempted to find out why an increasing number of Muslims had come to hate the West. This is 8 years before September 11. We filmed in Beirut, southern Lebanon, Israel, the occupied West Bank and Gaza, Egypt, Bosnia and Croatia. Among many stories we filmed, we followed the last and hopeless attempts of a Palestinian farmer to hold on to his land, land which the Israelis wanted to use as part of a settlement. We also filmed, I should add, the story of a Palestinian refugee in Beirut who drew a map of the home he left as a little boy in Acre, a home which we then visited and found inside an elderly Israeli who had lost his home in Poland in 1939. So not only did we film the man in his home, the Palestinian's home in Acre, we then went off to film the house in Poland he came from. Indeed, we knocked on the front door, a woman opened it and said, "Are they coming back?" So we followed, you see, we followed the refugee cycle right round Poland, Israel, Palestine, Israel, Beirut. Our camera crew and our director, Mike Dutfield, and myself hoped that that film might help to save Mohammed Hatib's home. However, I have to tell you that before Christmas, just before Christmas of 1993, he was expelled from the house with his family and ended up living with relatives in that village of Hizme, which you saw in the distance when Mickey Molad was pointing it out. Shortly after this series aired on Discovery, a series of pro-Israeli lobby groups, including Camera, the Camera Media Resources Centre, I think it's in Boston, bombarded the channel with complaints. Joseph Ungar wrote to complain that for me to say that Israel confiscates or occupies land and builds huge Jewish settlements on Arab land was twisted history. To say that the Falangist militia had been sent into Sabra Shatila by Israel was an egregious falsehood. We'd mentioned that in the documentary. At one point, one of the lobbyists wrote that I was Henry Higgins with fangs. Obviously, he liked My Fair Lady. Pouring venom into the living rooms of America. Alex Safian of Camera wrote to Clark Bunting, senior vice president of Discovery, on the 9th of June 1994, claiming that a sequence in our film which showed the Israelis refusing to allow a Palestinian woman to go to hospital during a Gaza curfew may have been staged for the camera. The claim was totally false. Indeed, we found the woman still in her home after an Israeli officer, believing our camera had been turned off, lied to us by claiming that a car had taken her to the hospital. Discovery subsequently rang me in Beirut to say they were receiving lots of letters condemning the films from various groups. Then-director Mike Dutfield and I heard that Discovery had cancelled a re-showing. In an imperishable letter to Dutfield, Bunting wrote as follows, and I ask you not to laugh until the end. "Given the reaction to the series upon its initial airing, we never scheduled a subsequent airing, so there is not really an issue as to any scheduled re-airing being cancelled." When I read those words, ladies and gentlemen, I was ashamed to be a foreign correspondent. Interestingly,
The condemnation and abuse I regularly receive, and my colleagues too, far outnumbered, I should add, by literally thousands of emails praising the Independent's coverage of the Middle East, and particularly that of my colleague in Jerusalem, Phil Reeves, has increased significantly since the Independent became available through its website, www.independent.co.uk, to internet users throughout the world, especially America. Many American readers appear to lament their own lobotomized journalistic coverage, as one recent email remarked. A number of letters of support also came from American Jewish readers, but the mailbag contains the usual vitriol. Last year, an American law student at a British university wrote to tell me that I was an evil fucking man. A remark he withdrew when I called him at college and threatened to report his remarks to the British police as a threatening letter. He had, of course, obligingly added his phone number onto the email. Another letter, anonymous this time, began, "To Mr. Shit Fisk. You are what you are, an evil medieval anti-Semite. Your judgment day will come." That's gone on my bathroom wall. One of the most recent messages which has not gone on the bathroom wall, again anonymous and this time thrown with disgust by me into the garbage bin, contained the accusation that my mother must have been Eichmann's daughter. My mother, Peggy, died in 1998 after a long struggle with Parkinson's disease. In 1940, at the height of the Second World War, she was an RAF radio repair mechanic repairing the radios in damaged Spitfires during the Battle of Britain. In South Africa, where our sister paper, the Johannesburg Star, publishes my reports, a number of rabbis complained that I was helping the right-wing historian and Holocaust denier David Irving. I have never met David Irving, and I don't want to. Denial of the Jewish Holocaust I regard as a wicked act. The rabbis then just withdrew their complaint. Then the Israeli ambassador to Ireland used the platform of a question and answer session at a meeting of an Irish charity in Belfast, of all places, to attack my reporting. I was given no right of reply, of course. I wasn't invited. It was a closed meeting, and I only heard later what the ambassador had said. He didn't realise I used to be the Northern Ireland correspondent, had lots of friends there to tell me what was going on. But I wrote, of course, I wrote about the ambassador's remarks in The Independent. And the Israeli ambassador to Dublin subsequently complained to us that he had made his remarks off the record. Now, this was very revealing. You see, the ambassador to Dublin didn't want to be reported. He wanted his remarks to harm my work, but he didn't want to be on the record as doing the harm. So I put him on the record. Can we journalists ignore the abuse and the lobby groups and the attempt to soft-pedal our reporting about the Middle East? White House spokesman Ari Fleischer's remark last October that, I quote, "The press is asking a lot of questions that I suspect the American people would prefer not to be asked or answered," carried, I thought, its own ominous implications. And CNN boss Walter Isaacson's instruction to staff that it seems perverse to focus too much on the casualties or hardship in Afghanistan because it ran the risk of helping the Taliban, was perhaps the most shameful journalistic remark ever to come from a media head in this country. So what has been happening to us all in the months since September the 11th? You know, we spent decades preaching to the Third World, to China, to the Soviet Union, to Black Africa and the Arabs about law, democracy, human rights and fair trials. But the moment our glittering towers were struck, I think we tore up those old lectures, imprisoned hundreds on suspicion here in the United States, brought prisoners drugged and blindfolded to Guantanamo Bay, bombed the poorest country in the world and killed thousands of its citizens. In any ordinary crime, even domestic crime, the first thing the cops do is look for the motive. Yet when this most terrible of crimes was committed last September, no one was allowed to look for a motive, save for the preposterous theory that the killers destroyed so many lives because they didn't like democracy. Most of them wouldn't know what democracy was. Oddly, the killers, as we know, were not from the deprived. They didn't come from the slums or the refugee camps. I visited the home of Ziad Jarrah, the Lebanese suicide pilot, who came from a village in the Bekaa Valley of Lebanon. This was the pilot of the plane which crashed in Pennsylvania, whose passengers so courageously changed the script and tried to take the plane back.
Ziad Jarrah's parents were middle class. I found his mother was a school teacher and his father a civil servant in the Lebanese government. They desperately wanted to believe that their son was an innocent passenger on the plane. His father wept in front of me because I'm sure he knew the truth. His son had a girlfriend, a Turkish girl, who was to have met his parents last summer before their engagement was announced. In the end, she travelled alone to meet them, a very strange arrangement in Lebanon, to let your future fiancé meet your parents but not in your presence. And of course, Jarrah had informed her that he was too busy with flight training in the States. You bet he was. His father had sent him, he told me, $2,000 3 days before September the 11th. And on the 10th, the day before, Ziad Jarrah rang his parents to thank them for the money. I suspect it was used to buy airline tickets. He had, I later discovered, been in Afghanistan for 6 weeks. He had been non-political before that. But as a boy, he had been trapped in Beirut by the 1982 Israeli invasion, spending weeks, 2 months in all, under shellfire. Had this touched him, I wondered, as it did so many others at that time? After all, the Lebanese Hezbollah were born in 1982. What are we to make, to learn of the personal reasons for the crimes against humanity of September the 11th? Not much. The middle-class murderers, of course, left no statements. Their message was their deed. But it came from the Middle East. It came from a land that has been deceived and mistreated and humiliated for decades. Was the world really changed forever? I don't think so. Perhaps America. Perhaps America was. But why should the world be changed? Back in 1982, as I told you, 17,500 people died during the Israeli invasion, almost all of them civilians, killed in just 3 months. And at the Sabra and Shatila camps, as I said, 1,700 innocents were slaughtered, more than half the death toll of the Twin Towers. But no one lit candles for them. There were no church services. No one remembered. The world did not change. Last fall, when I was in Pakistan, I watched on television Colin Powell telling us from Louisburg University that never again can we look up into the pale blue sky and see an airliner and think the same thing again. I think this is rubbish. I look up every day from my balcony in Beirut and see planes flying on their flight path, and they land at Beirut Airport. I fly on a lot more planes than Secretary Powell, and they all land at my destination. You know, without in any way belittling the horror and the evil of that terrible day, I do sometimes wonder, and I ask you to forgive me if you find this hard to take, but I do sometimes wonder whether Americans' concentration on that one day, to the point where we cannot discuss the whys, isn't becoming a form of dangerous self-absorption. But let's go back to the point. Can we really go on depicting, we journalists, the tragedy of the Middle East through a distorted lens, where illegal colonies are settlements and then just neighbourhoods, where we pretend that occupied land is merely disputed or war-won, where the Israeli siege of a Palestinian town becomes a closure, where Arab victims are killed in crossfire, where a man held responsible for a massacre is called a warrior, where uncomfortable atrocities are pushed into the sixth paragraph, and where a Holocaust is downgraded to ethnic cleansing? We journalists, I think, have to learn to suffer the sticks and stones. They can't be as painful as the stones that hit me in Kila Abdullah. All we have to do, I think, is risk the crossfire and remember the whys and tell the truth, or, as you would say in America, to tell it how it is. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.